Hello, it's Anna Perrow and Sophie Little here. We run Soundyard and we are the producers of Chris Skinner's Countryside podcast.
We're excited to tell you we've been nominated for an award. It's a public vote, so if you'd like to vote for us, well, that would just be amazing. You can head to norfolkartsawards.org.
Look out for Soundyard. We're under the Broadcast and Media Award, and it's such a pleasure putting the show together and listening with you.
So let's join Chris and Matthew on High Ash Farm.
Good morning and welcome to High Ash Farm. It's Thursday, the 2nd of November, and we're about to have a storm go right over the top of us here. The low pressure is the centre will be around about Norwich area in about an hour's time. The winds haven't yet arrived, but we've had close to another inch of rain here at the farm overnight. And standing at the front of the garage in the middle of the farmyard, and the water is overflowing the gutters. And you can hear it splashing down. Now, when you have very low pressure, some interesting phenomena happen here at the farm, because all over the farmyard, to have water for the livestock and for drinking in the farmhouse, there were a number of very deep wells dug by hand. They were bricked down to about 20 feet, 25 feet, and after that, the wells were just not lined at all. They were dug through heavy chalk, which is quite stable, and then the wells go down to the bottom, well over 100 feet deep. That's well over 30 metres. And then each side at the bottom were little channels dug, again, just about tall enough for a man to stand in. And at this time, when you have these very low pressures, the air trapped in those wells, which have all been sealed over, they've all got ventilation pipes on the top of. My terrible rat has gone into the log pile behind me, and he thinks he can smell something in the back, because in weather like this, the other thing that happens is lots of rats and mice leave their field where they've been living all over the summer months, and they desert the fields. They seem to know when bad weather's coming, and they migrate to the nearest shelter, which in this case is the buildings here at High Ash Farm. So Rat thinks he's smelt a rat, if you can follow that. But I'm going to get back to this particular well. Is 36 metres deep, so way over 100 feet down. It's 5 feet in diameter, and it was the major well. The water was pumped out of it originally by a windmill, which blew down in 1953, and then electric pumps, and then subsequently the farm went on to mains water. But the air, which was much higher pressure over recent days, before this low pressure arrived, went into the well. And as the pressure is dropping so rapidly now, this is rather like a huge barometer that you might have in your house. Now, the air's rushing out, so I'm just going to walk up to the vent, because there's an extraordinary sound. If I had a whistle on the top of the well, we'd be hearing it all over the farm as a kind of warning that the pressure's dropped rapidly. That means we're going to have some quite severe winds quite shortly, although it's uncannily still at the moment. It's like being in the centre of an imaginary hurricane. Just have a listen to this. Back to work.
Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast.
High Ash Farm. It's the Countryside Podcast with Chris Skinner And Chris is meeting me here, and here he is in the woods with just the woodland floor strewn with, I call it, badger food.
Yes, it is badger food, squirrel food, deer food. I could just see a squirrel running through the undergrowth behind us. So, yes, you said woodland, and that's exactly what we're in. Another squirrel just over there in front of... There it goes,
yes.
Just hopping through. And they're all busy harvesting this sort of incredible crop of sweet chestnuts, not one of our native trees. And what we're looking at this morning is woodland. Woodland, particularly here at High Ash Farm, has a huge history and is as important today as it probably was centuries and centuries ago. But woodland is a really interesting word because it's got the word wood, obviously, at the beginning of it. And many people would walk in here and say it's a forest. But a forest is kind of man-made, planted. The Forestry Commission was established in 1913, so 110 years ago. And they're really typical. They planted their trees, particularly conifers, close together in rows as well. And when you look around here, none of the trees, although they're magnificent and some of them are giant, none of them are in rows.
So it's gloriously random. And I have to say, the woodland is now, as we get into November, all opened up again, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And there's our friends in the Air Force.
Yes,
well.
they think they knew they were here, and they had to form part of the Countryside podcast, of course. So, right, something strange happens at this time of the year. The light level in the woodland increases on a day-to-day basis because... The Americans have got a lovely name for it. It's called fall. And at this time of the year, the leaves have done their job. The chlorophyll starts to die back. And when you look above your head, you can see some of the leaves on this sweet chestnut tree gone a lovely golden yellow. And already on the ground, sycamore leaves, sweet chestnut leaves, lovely golden colour leaves with a sort of serrated edge that looks like a sawtooth edge. Quite large leaves. And already they've lost their hold on the twigs they were on. So at this time of the year, a little layer forms between where the twig attaches itself, the leaf attaches itself to the twig, and eventually this little corky layer, that's the doom for the leaf, and eventually the leaf then drops off. But before that, all that green colour that was in the leaf has drained away, look, and you've got this lovely golden colour, different species, lovely crunchy.
It's like paper, that.
It is, yes. Anyway, the colours that were masked by the chlorophyll, the green colour, come out, and we've got some maple trees at the end of the woodland. If you look through the wood, there's some early morning sunshine over there, and you can see the maple trees over there, field maple, which is a British native species, is glowing in the low sunshine.
It's a magnificent sight in autumn, that, isn't
it? It is, and we've got the low light coming through the woodland now, and it's really beautiful.
Still a lot of leaves to come off, though.
Oh, yes, yeah, we're about halfway, and they all come off in succession. So some of the introduced species, things like horse chestnut, for instance, sycamore, with the leaves all around us, they're both introduced. There are only 35 British native trees in our country, and we call them native because years ago we were standing under hundreds of feet of ice here. It was the last ice age about 10,000 years ago, and eventually the ice sheet started to retreat. It melted and moved back northwards, and just at the current stage in the world, we've got the Antarctica and Arctic sort of polar regions where there's ice most of the time in the glaciers. But when they melted, it filled in where we currently call the North Sea and the English Channel, that you could walk across to Europe way back then, because the water was all in the form of ice. And so we were then cut off once that happened, and at that point the only trees that were already here at the end of the Ice Age, it was very cold and inhospitable to start with, so you only had mosses, lichens, then a few birch trees got established, and eventually, about 7,000 years ago, oaks, Scots Pine and that list of 35 I mentioned establish themselves. Everything after that's been introduced. So Christmas trees or Norway spruce in the 16th century, cedar of Lebanon in the
Lombardy 17th. Poplars.
Oh, of course, yes. They're a much later introduction. Horse chestnuts in the 18th century, a non-native species, together with the sycamore. And then in the 19th century, Wellingtonias or redwoods by Field Marshal Wellington. And we're in Wellingtons this morning, and he got the name from Field Marshal Wellington, obviously. So there's a lot of history. Now, it's really interesting because the woodlands here were hugely important because they were a source of fuel or wood rather than the timber, which we currently think of in forestry. So lots of clues right beside us here. So we're just going to walk into the woodland a little bit. Magnificent oak tree there, all gnarled and knotted with burrs all the way up the trunk, and that's probably 250-300 years old.
What causes those burrs?
Right, that's a kind of reaction. Sometimes you'll get a fungus in and the tree will react to that. But that tree trunk in a normal oak tree would be perhaps worth £300 or £400 for timber, but with the burrs on it, it's three or four times that because it gives the grain a fantastic pattern. And so all the way up the trunk to quite a height, probably about 30 feet up, there are burrs on it, and that makes wonderful kitchen furniture for really expensive kitchens. So you can have burred oak, it's called. B-U-R-R-E-D.
I've got a feeling you're not going to let anyone in with an axe.
No. Now, look at this. This is one sweet chestnut tree. Tell me how many trunks you can count.
Well, there's one base, and then it splits into two.
No.
Oh, through
it's,
here.
It's all one. It's all one tree, look.
One, two, three, four, five.
And look at the size of each of them.
The size of a full tree.
Exactly, and that's called coppicing. Right.
Oh, that's a man-made process.
It absolutely is, and much of this wood was coppiced for wood. Now, wood would include posts, rails, and anything in small timber. And it was in huge demand in farming years ago because you made your fences from it. And it was really, really an important part of the history of the woodland here. And so coppicing, and the same happened further down the wood. There's a gentle slope all the way down here, and we have coppiced hazel as well. And even my father, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, there was stacks in the farmyard to be thrashed in the autumn, and he would have brooches to knock into the thatch on the top of the stacks, and it was all done with string, and so you would use hazel for that, and it also made lap fencing as well. So lots of history.
And coppicing is to cut back quite severely and artificially promote the growth of these different...
Yes, and you'd have a whole crop of poles, but eventually we discovered coal in the late Middle Ages, and coppicing, although it carried on for quite a while, gradually died out in favour of, you know, getting coal, which was much cheaper and easier and didn't involve all this hard work. So that's one of the clues that this is fairly ancient woodland. And as we walk through the wood a little bit in a few minutes, we'll look at some of the other clues. But when I walk into a woodland, I look out for four things. I look for the ground layer, which would include the mosses. Here we are, look, there's an old stump here, covered in moss and algae and lichens. Oh, and it's a lovely round this side, Matthew. Just look, it's beautiful, sort of woodland green colour.
Oh, yes.
Some lovely species of moss there. And also the sort of understory here, which would be things like bluebells. And the whole of this area where we're standing has snowdrops, bluebells, wood anemones, and early purple orchids, and they're not here. It's like, it's magic, and that's the interesting thing about woodland. It changes almost on a weekly basis. So we're now going to walk to a different part of the wood and look at another clue of the history which this wood was used for.
Oh, Well, even more brightness here on this November morning, the sun glinting through the trees. We're still in the woodland, Chris.
Yes, just wonderful time of year. And there's also some clues in the scents in the air. There's lots of fungi come out at this time of year, and it sort of permeates into my nostrils, and I then walk up the wind and find various species of fungi which really smell at this time of the year. Phallus impudicus is one called a stinkhorn. And that sort of, you can smell it 50 yards away. And I like following the trail of the smell. Now, we said we're going to look for other clues of use of this particular area of woodland that shows it's quite ancient. Now, we looked at coppicing and what that does. And the next method is called pollarding. Right. Now, completely different. And here we have a pollarded oak. And it's truly magnificent. It's an English oak, a pedunculate oak, and the trunk is about, 8-9 feet tall, and then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 remaining branches on it, and some of the old branches, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, have snapped off.
There's a hollow one behind you there.
Yes, yes.
Look at that, you can see daylight through
it. Yes, you can, and some of the old branches are laying underneath because one of the important things in woodland is deadwood, and over 1,000 different species of fungi and insects have been recorded living in deadwood. It's almost as important as the living wood itself. Now, coppicing is one thing, but pollarding is much more brutal in a way. So you actually take a tree and you take the branches off about 8 or 9 feet up the tree, and that was sort of to let the light in on the woodland floor so that you could graze cattle underneath it, but it also provided that important asset that we talked about, which is called wood, which was used for fuel. And also some of the branches, the larger ones, could be used for stakes in the ground because wood lasts a long time in the ground, oak wood in particular. This tree would be no good for timber for shipbuilding. Remember, we were a seafaring nation and oak was always used for building the hulls. But when you look at the branch, one of the back branches here, this one curls right over the one right above our head here, and what happens there, that natural curl would be used in the hull of the boat. It would be actually cut out on a curve and used for the timbers for the sort of spine of the boat. So lots of parts. And I was standing under here this spring and there was some pecking noises going on, and there was a great spotted woodpecker underneath one of the branches there, pecking away, actually underneath and upside down to prevent any squirrels going in. And that's the other thing you can look for when you come into old woodland, the variety of wildlife that it supports. In this woodland, we are really lucky. There are all three British native species of woodpecker. The great spot, which is the common one that you'll see in the garden on your peanuts if you like to feed them. The green woodpecker, or the yaffle, which is the largest of the three species. And we have two pairs here at Hirish Farm of Dendrocoppus minor, which is the lesser spot woodpecker. I love those. They're not much larger than a large sparrow, and they will go up into the canopy. They spend most of their life way up in the trees there. They particularly like the old dead wood. They can peck away and get insects, and this time of the year, bonanza time for them. The moths start laying their eggs in the tips of the oak branches. Species called winter moth, which you can see in November and onwards this time of the year.
And you hear them rather than see them.
Yes, they're little woodland drummer birds. The great spot and the lesser spot frequently drum in January and February. And then the other wildlife you'll look for to give you clues is the area we're standing there. And we're being filmed at the moment, whether you like it or not, because I've got security cameras here. There are two cameras and they are filming the badgers, but also, because this area just to the edge of the wood is permissive access, and I'm very protective of this area. The whole thing is like a moonscape, and it's one of the largest badger sets in East Anglia.
In fact, there are several other sets now that have come as offshoots.
Yes, they have. We got a total of three badger sets at Hirish Farm. Occasionally you have big family arguments, and some of the inhabitants of the set will move off. It gets so heated that they'll set up another set all by themselves. And we've got, so really blessed to have badgers, sort of the world's original landowners, if you like.
And the sets will always be in woodland like this for food and for cover?
Yes, yeah. And really, badgers, the main part of their diet, which is quite surprising, is worms and slugs and snails. They love those. And so that's another clue as to old woodland, the amount of different wildlife or biodiversity that the woodland supports. So I'm not a tidy farmer in the woodland. There's lots of trees laying down, lots of branches there. And also, you have to remember that these oak trees, although they're old and venerable, they also live and they die as well. And here is one that was the sort of formal entrance to High Ash Farm. These two pollarded oak trees, one behind us, and this one fell down when I was about 4 or 5 years old in 1953. So it's taken...
I thought you were going to say it happened a few years ago.
No, it's taken...
75
years ago. It's taken
years
70 years plus to reach this state. And we'll walk up. It's still got the shell of a hollow. I can just tap it a little bit like that. And it's still hollow, but we can look inside it and you can actually see the decay mechanism. I'll just put my hand down, reach down into the hollow, and... there we go, and I'll bring a handful out. Look, that is the remains of an oak tree, and it's returned to peat.
But 70 years, yeah, that has been providing cover and habitat and food and all sorts of other nutrients.
They say oak trees take at least 100 years to grow, so another 100 years to mature, and if not longer, because oaks, one of the longest living trees in our countryside, our native trees, can live up to 700 or 800 years quite comfortably, and then they return to the soil. So this hasn't been sawn up, it was left, some of the old limbs are there, and it was the big storms in 1953 that brought it down. And my father used to come and tell me it was the brother pollarded tree to that one over there.
That one survived, this one didn't.
Yes, so let's just walk down the hill a little bit, because I said there's life and death every day in woodland. It's a kind of really dynamic environment, you could describe it. Now, this was a lovely clear track. I walked down it yesterday evening. Just look in front of us.
Oh, just yonder there, there's a tree right across the track, and that's not a small tree, is it?
No, it's one of the giants of the woodland. Although that we missed most of the winds in Storm Ciara last night and the day before when it first arrived. Nevertheless, the woodland floor became flooded, and it's a wash here.
It's still very wet, isn't it?
And it's still soaking wet, and that's what did the tree in. It's a giant oak tree, curved on the trunk, so it wasn't completely perpendicular. It was leaning slightly over the track to get the light, but they say every cloud has a silver lining. You can see where the water gushed through, went round the root system of the tree, and just by virtue of its own weight, it cascaded over onto the track.
So fatally weakening the roots.
Yes.
All this
yes.
water, and we're still in water here, aren't
we? Yeah, we're standing in water, and the water's still flowing through the woodland here.
Such a shame, isn't it?
It's a beautiful, beautiful oak tree. But they say every cloud has a silver lining. When you look above us, we've now got clear sky instead of the shade provided by the oak tree. And that will provide sort of a foothold for young trees, which are already probably germinated all round in the understory here. And they will be trees of the future. But just let's walk down it, because here's the trunk and it's beautifully curved. No use for house timbers or anything, or oak wood's quite valuable.
But a battleship you could build out of it.
I could build a battleship, yes, just give me a chainsaw. But I'm going to do something even more interesting, and I'll cut the trunk there, and I will have a 15-foot long curved seat for people to sit on, because we're quite close to permissive walks at the farm. I've already made a few, I found out how to do it. Trial and error. I made lots of errors, but I know how to do it now. And it's a kind of double oak tree, and I'm wondering whether it was coppiced in the past, because there's two trunks coming off the base, and we can actually walk round and actually see what caused the damage here. It was just the fact that it was standing in water and
the soil is so wet.
It was just the whole base of the tree. That's what happened in 1987. And you can see a big plate of soil on the bottom. It pulled all the roots out, and then the water carried on gushing through the wood and has left a trail that this was a raging river only 24 hours ago. That was a standing, beautiful oak tree, and it's starting that process of rotting back down into the woodland floor. So I'll just clear the track, but I'll leave all the top each side of the track and the old stump as well.
And that'll be there for 100 years to come.
Hopefully, yes.
One of the great joys of our weekly countryside podcast is all the lovely letters and emails we get to the programme. And if you don't hear yourself mentioned, it's not that it's not been read. It's just that there's a time constraint, isn't there, Chris?
Yes, the volume of response to the podcast is very gratifying, and particularly some of the comments that we get.
Well, here's one from Andy, who listens in the West Country, loves the show. It's a real treat in my busy schedule, he says. He's got 2 acres, a traditional orchard, and about 7 years ago, he planted predominantly cider apples and traditional West Country varieties. Sounds wonderful, that. He also says, I've tried to grow a flower meadow, but the yellow rattle failed. I'll try again this year, having killed off the grass with sheeting. Perhaps the one question I have right now is, what can I do about nettles?
Nettles, oh right. Well, a brilliant conservation plant, the sort of food plant of many of our butterfly species, peacock butterflies, red admiral as well, small tortoiseshell. So as far as that goes, the more nettles you have, the better. But the second point is, if you want to restrict the area of nettles, and without using chemicals, because of the shape of a nettle stem, it's almost square and it's very prone to being kinked over. So if you've got a small area that you want to control the nettles on, please leave some of them. You can use a little hand roller just as they come through, and about 8 to 10 inches high. They then that will break the stem over. That then weakens the rootstock. Then you do it again 2 or 3 times over the summer months, and sadly that would be the end of the nettles, but with no chemical control. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is yellow rattle, to restrict the grass growth. Sadly, you don't need to use sheeting to kill the grass. You can use yellow rattle. It will naturally parasitise the grass, but it will take a year or two to get going. That then reduces the vigour of the grassland. You can then sow your wildflowers in amongst that. Some seeds you can sow without cultivating, things like oxeye daisy, several species that you can grow that are good for pollen and nectar, and they don't need moved soil. Some species that we talk about does need soil to be moved.
And thanks to Andy for that email. I'll give the email address out again in just a moment. First though, Patricia Monkman says, Hi Chris, I wondered if you could tell me what these fruits are. And there's an enclosed photograph of some apples. Every year this very old tree with an apparently divided trunk produces these small fruit, approximately 2 to 2.5 centimetres. That's about an inch, isn't it? They fall from the tree in autumn at the size of the ones in this photo. They're eventually eaten by the sheep and birds. It's a mystery that is only the left side of the tree that fruits. The tree is flanked by hawthorn. We did just wonder if it's a crab apple tree.
And you're quite right. It's exactly what it is. Lovely tree to have. It's in the shrub layer in the woodland behind us here, and it produces these tiny fruit, which are incredibly acidic at this time of the year. But as the frosts, as we go through autumn into winter, the sugars start to become more apparent, and they're usually devoured by redwing and field fares, our winter visiting thrushes, much later in the year.
We've had a letter in for, or an email from Les Black from Attleborough, and thank you very much for that. And we've read that very carefully, and
yes.
We're very sad to hear about your loss.
Yes, a very moving letter. Had several of us almost close to tears, but thank you so much for the wonderful comments on
Countryside podcast. Very warmly received.
And here's one from Sally Lee. I spend a lot of time indoors because I'm not too well, but I love the podcast. It takes me into the English countryside. Sally says we're planning to move from London to a bungalow in the middle of a very large village. Which small trees or shrubs would you recommend to link our garden to the countryside surrounding and also to benefit wildlife? So is there any good tips?
Yes, there is. I've got two straight off the top of my head. They're British natives. So the first one would be the rowan tree, which doesn't make a large tree, so it won't become too invasive in the garden. See if you can choose one of the old traditional varieties. They've been kind of messed around with a little bit, the sorbus species. And you look for one with the orange berries on. That would be really helpful, so it's not too invasive. And the other one would be, if you have a wall or a tree already in the area, put some ivy at the bottom of it. Brilliant for nesting and useful for wildlife all the year round. Or if you've got a north-facing wall, one of the thorn species, like pyracantha, this variety would be orange glow, and that produces berries even on the north-facing wall, and you'll have the pollen and nectar in the spring months, and then the bright orange berries at this time of the year to feed the winter thrushes.
And here's our final one, a message from Richard Turkington, who says he's enjoying the new podcast. But a week or two ago, I was teaching some students with the classroom window open and heard what I thought were crows making a racket for quite a while. At break, I went out to see two magpies, quite animated, up near the top of a silver birch, making a sound like a crow. Do magpies do this sometimes?
Yes, they do. In fact, magpies are crows, although the scientific name is pika pika. And so, yes, they make a noise exactly like a crow, as well as that quick-firing machine gun call that they have when they see you in the garden. But they were getting animated with each other. They, at this time of the year, they're beginning to pair up all the corvid species, and they were just being aggressive with each other, and they do sound exactly like a crow when that happens. They'll also give you a warning if there's a cat or a dog in the garden or you're near their nest next spring. They will make that particular sound to try and frighten you off. So there we are. They are crows.
If it's a crow, yes, it's got to be a magpie. Now, thank you for all your correspondence, and there'll be plenty more time in future weeks on the Countryside podcast. So if you want to send an email and Chris will have a look at it, the address is quite simply chris@countrysidepodcast.co.uk. You'll find links to it on the website, but chris@countrysidepodcast.co.uk. Or if you want to send a letter, and some people still do that, then you'll be able to find online the address of Chris's home, and just mark it Chris Skinner, Norfolk, and it'll get here.
Yes.
No, yeah. You probably want to do much more than that. But High Ash Farm, Caister St Edmunds.
Yes, that should find me. Yes, I'm well known by the postman and the post ladies. Yes, they groan under the basket. Look, Matthew, just behind us, all the jackdaws flying over. We just had some rooks go over our head. Lovely time of year. And they're doing their courtship displays, corkscrewing down to the ground just to impress the girls.
We'll carry on our Countryside podcast with Chris Skinner here in the woodland. And, we've just done a bit of a climb, haven't we?
Yes, this is the old river cliff, and we're about halfway up it. It's close to 25 metres high, which is 75 feet, and it's a pretty sheer drop. So we have to walk up sideways, or we'll be slipping and getting muddy trousers.
We did use the crampons and the rope, didn't we?
I think we did need that. But I said I wasn't a tidy farmer in the woodland here. And there's lots of old trees. There's an oak tree and a venerable beech tree, both of which snapped off in a gale about 10 years ago. And I've left the stumps, one of which is 15 feet tall and the other's about 6 or 7 feet tall. And already they're being attacked by various species of fungi. And it's always really interesting to see the different species. They all attack the wood in a kind of succession. The early ones actually can invade the woodland and the wood itself and cause damage, and then you have a succession coming on later, and some of them are really attractive. So I'll get close to one. That low sunshine is coming on, and this is called turkey tail.
This is growing out of the trunk of the old tree here.
It's a bracket fungus, lots of little flat horizontal brackets on there.
It almost looks like a seashell, doesn't it?
It does, yes, and because it's so wet at the moment, you can actually see little lines around the top of the fungus on the top of the bracket, and that's meant to represent a cock turkey when he fans his tail, and that's what gave it its name. And on the underside of the brackets here, just underneath, you can see it's quite light coloured, and as they begin to form full maturity, spores drop out, which has made all these bottom ones white, as though they've been dusted with flour, and that's the fungal spores of the fruiting part. So what we're looking at is just a tiny fraction of that fungi's year's growth. It spends the rest of the year just under the bark in an invisible sort of fungal threads called hyphae. And there's another one here which is a little bit interesting. That's called Gandomera, and that's just beginning to form. It looks like a chocolate cake with white cream on the underside of
it. Yes, it's the same white as like a mushroom you'd buy in the supermarket.
Yes.
But the black bit at the top looks like someone's burnt the cakes.
Yes, and so this is what it looks like when it's mature. It's really hard, and you can almost sort of put your foot on it and using it as a step to climb up the tree. And yes, and yet another one here, which is called a hoof fungus, and it looks exactly like a horse's hoof. You can see
that almost looks wet.
It does, yes. The rain has run down the old tree trunk onto this fungus. There's bracken growing out of it, and that's why when you look at the woodland, you need to look at all these different areas. So we've looked at the sort of ground fungi and what we call a field layer. Oh, some beautiful turkey tail fungus just down here. Just I hadn't seen those. They're freshly emerged and very colourful. And then the moss looks like sort of coniferous trees growing over the bark there. It is really beautiful, and some of the fungi are incredibly colourful as well. We've got fly agaric growing down in the silver birch clumps at the bottom of the wood.
Those are the red toadstools.
That's right, but as red as my face and covered in white spots, but I'm lacking the spots. I had them when I was a teenager, but they are really, really unusually beautiful. So as we look round, you can see more of the understory here. There's some silver birch behind us, a lovely birch, and then we turn round this side and you've got this sort of shrub layer which I describe, which is about halfway between the canopy way up above us where all the big branches and the leaves are, and this layer. And so holly is growing here. So it looks a bit unusual because it's halfway up a hill, but it was growing under the shade of these two trees, and holly is a shade loving plant. It will grow in the sort of darkest areas of woodland and produce berries, so it's obviously a female there, and it's covered in holly berries. And already another thing you can judge the woodland by is the amount of bird life in there. We mentioned the woodpeckers, but this time of the year you have whitecap, blackcap, chiffchaffs. Most of those will have migrated south at the moment, and they're now replaced by another raft of birds coming in from the near continent. Redwing, fieldfares joining our resident blackbirds and song thrushes, and they'll be pillaging those just like Viking raiders from years ago. So those berries probably won't make it to December the 25th.
As the days get darker, though, it's a welcome splash of colour, isn't it? The red dots.
It is, absolutely. So we'll just make our ascent up to the top of the hill, and then there's another old giant down the other side here, which has crashed onto the woodland floor. One I used to gather conkers from as a boy. It's a giant horse chestnut. So in front of us is a lovely old horse chestnut tree. There's one here beside us, already lost most of its leaves because it's used to the countryside it comes from, sort of Central Europe. It's an introduced species. This one had its life in front of us.
Yes, he's now horizontal, sadly.
Yeah, and it was a magnificent tree. And again, it's caused that big light area above us. So already foxgloves are beginning to grow where it stood. And all the way up the trunk, we have the more invasive species of fungi. This one's called honey fungus, Armillaria malea. And that's a real problem. It's got several other names as well, called bootlace fungus. And if I pulled some of the bark off the tree, we might come across some of the bootlaces. Worms under there. The rotting process is still well underway. And you can see where the bootlaces went up the trunk. And that's where you get these fruiting bodies.
So it's pretty much a death sentence, is it, to a tree?
Yes, fungi, but it was also hugely important. It's the sort of natural rotting down process of the wood, and there's a huge succession of them. And in beech trees, they can get infected with fungi, and little black threads. It's rather like looking at a very mature cheese with the black threads or the dark blue threads going through the cheese itself. The veins, that's right. And so in beech trees, they can get infected with a fungal infection. Various species will cause it, and it causes a condition called spalting. And furniture makers and people who make ornamental bowls absolutely love it. You can have a bowl all with these black lines going through it, and it looks absolutely exquisite. And I just noticed as we walk down the hill there, there's a tree which was standing yesterday. Another one has come down, and it's covered in a fungus. We're nearly there. Let's just walk up this slope. Big hollow in that one. Lovely place for bats to hibernate. And gnats as well in there. That's in this old horse chestnut tree. Just look at this one in front of us. It's covered in jelly ear. And let's have a little look. All the way up there.
My goodness, the jelly ear is all the way down.
Yes, it is. Look, it's hundreds of them. Absolutely, and it looks exactly like a human ear.
Yeah, sort of brownish, gelatinous colour.
Yes, it is. And it's a sort of one of the jelly fungi. And underneath, you can almost see little veins as well, just would be exactly like on the inside of your ear. So, lots and lots of life. And they're in sort of, usually you'll see it on elder. This one's on an old deceased elm tree, and it's fallen down, would you believe, last night. This was standing here, covered in these fungi. And they're almost translucent when you look at the top of the tree. The light's coming through them. And so all it's doing is feeding on that. The spores will then come out, infect other plants, and particularly elder in this area of woodland. And there, and sometimes the fungi are tiny. These are the size of pin's head. This is on a twig just laying on the ground. That's called coral spot. And it's a beautiful, beautiful colour. Absolutely coral colour is the only way to halfway in pink and red.
It's that orangey colour, isn't
yes.
it? Yes, and it's all spotted and dotted.
Yes, so really beautiful. So although many people think that late autumn and early winter is a dead time of year in the countryside, it's anything but. It's all happening. All the bulbs under the soil, the snowdrops, the bluebells, the orchids are all getting themselves ready to burst out, as they have done for thousands of years here, because this has never been ploughed. It's too steep for horses to be on. So it holds a lot of clues as to its past and its past use. And today it's just a natural delight, and I think I always feel better when I've come down to this woodland, been here a little while, and then walked away. And of course at night time, thousands of corvids come here to roost as well. So we have deer here, foxes, badgers, and it's an absolute delight.
If you go down to the woods today, you're in for a big surprise.
You may see me.
This is a Soundyard production. Music is by Tom Harris.
Hey! Hello, it's Sophie from Soundyard here. We're a non-profit production company and we produce Chris Skinner's Countryside Podcast. We're keen to get the word out about the podcast to as many people as possible, so we're printing some A3 posters with information about the show and how to access it to put up in community spots. Think community centres, libraries, cafes and pubs. And if you can think of any places they'd be warmly received near to you, or if you'd like some to distribute yourself, send us an email, chris@countrysidepodcast.co.uk. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're in a position to donate to the production costs, head to donorbox.org/countrysidepodcast. Thank you so much for all of your support.